Well, we are glad that everyone could take and come and join us tonight. Our guest for tonight is, and we're going to introduce him this way because we discussed it from the standpoint of we're going to have no acronyms. It's going to be all just what it stands for, so we don't lose anybody in the technical saying of what we are. Our guest tonight is a certified public accountant. That's CPA. He is also a certified tax coach, which is a big part of what we are discussing tonight, in that the concern for transfer of ownership of a business has an awful lot to do with keeping the IRS out of your pocket as you make the change. So he is a certified tax coach, which stands for CTC, if I've got that right. And a neat part with our guest, Mike, is that Mike is a former business owner. He came to being a CPA later on in life, and that is how we first met him. Matter of fact, it was
– damn it.
We had – when in creating the program, the way we have it, it was such that it was Mike who had the idea of we ought to have a guest on here. And so with that one and the time that he came to join us, it was pretty neat. So our guest, CPA, CTC, Mike McCormick from Cincinnati. And you're there tonight, Mr. Mike?
I'm here, Tom.
Glad to be back. Here's the reason. Sir?
I'm glad to be back.
No, we're glad to have you. We appreciate you being the expert who lends his time to help us with this discussion. Our concern and the reason for tonight's program is that in attending trade shows and conferences, there seems to be a growing number of people who are there exhibiting, and what they're exhibiting is their expertise to help you close a business. And I think that in our time together tonight, we need to discuss with people the ramifications, tax-wise and dollar-wise, the idea of what happens if you close a business. And let's look at it from the standpoint the other direction as to I'm thinking about how I want to come out of the business. And my contention has always been that as you're coming into business, you ought to have in mind how you're going to get out of the business. You know where the front door is, but you ought to kind of know where's the back door. Your opening thoughts, sir?
Well, I would agree with you. Most people who go into business are usually gung-ho about generating revenue, maintaining expenses, creating a customer list, an asset. What they don't spend a whole lot of time on, if any at all, certainly in the early years, is how do they sell this asset? How do they transfer it to the next generation? Do they bring in employees as additional owners? Usually that either happens, unfortunately, by a spouse or the estate of the business owner. It's really unfortunate that a lot of businesses end up getting transferred at the direction of the court rather than the direction of the business owner.
So for the first question I want to put in, would we say, I guess as a general rule, that if you are going to get out of business at some point in time, which all of us are, is it more likely that selling the business, transferring it, is going to put more money in your pocket than if you were to close the business?
Well, I would say, in general, I would say selling the business or maybe transferring it to the next generation is going to be the most beneficial to the business owner. Usually, if a business is liquidated and the assets are sold, it's usually at fire sale prices or the customer list has mysteriously evaporated because the business owner is no longer there to service them. So the value of the company depreciates rather quickly.
Mike, can I ask you, I want to go back to Tom's original question.
Sure.
These were kind of like one question that has four little subsets to it. And I agree with Tom that, you need to think about getting out of business once you post that first dollar bill on the wall and think about how I'm going to get out of here. but because we got a lot of stuff to do, I'll make this real quick. But it seems to me there's basically two or three or four questions that a business owner, when he starts really thinking of getting serious about selling, and I just want you to give me brief answers to these. The first one I've got down here is, do you really want to sell your business now? Is that a legitimate question to ask?
Well, do you really want to sell it now? That specific question may or may not be appropriate for any given business owner. But,
okay,
you know, it's like any other asset. There's a number on it. They may not have defined it yet, but if that number were to come along, it would either spur them into serious consideration of selling it or they would jump at it.
Right. Okay, and the second one, I'll kind of rattle off and off here, Mike. Would you rather keep your business in the family or would you rather sell it to strangers? You kind of answered
that
one already.
Good question. It's going to depend on the business owner.
Yeah. Okay. And then, you know, the third one I have is, what do they want to accomplish with the rest of their life? Do they want to dump out of the business and buy an island in the Caribbean? Do they want to hang around for a year and talk to their buddies and be a consultant? Do they want to work full-time? Do they want to work half-time? I think those are legitimate questions to ask oneself, don't you?
They're definitely legitimate questions. They strike to help the business owner define what it is they want to accomplish. And that's what all of this comes down to, is what is it that they want to accomplish? Are they running this business to ultimately pass it to the next generation or the third generation? And there are ways to do that extremely tax effectively. Do they want to, they don't want any family in it. Maybe for whatever reason, they just want the family to let go of it, so they sell it. Or
right.
Do they want to maybe put the business, have a portion of the business become an ESOP, an employee stock ownership program, where the employees start to take over ownership of it. Or maybe there's a charitable component to it. Maybe they want the assets ultimately to go, or not maybe not the assets, but the cash from the sale to go to their favorite
right.
charity.
Right.
It all turns back to what are the goals.
Right, and basically an owner's got to think of themselves. When push
Absolutely.
Comes to play. Yeah. Okay. Well, that was what I was getting at.
In any kind of any kind of planning that we do, whether it's tax or estate or financial or investment planning, it all comes down to what are the goals of
right.
the people or person who own the asset. And if their goal is to spend more time on the beach in Tampa, Florida, how can we arrange their affairs to do that? Maybe it's not selling the business at all. Maybe it's continuing to take distributions from the company or dividends and not take a salary anymore, and that will maintain the lifestyle. But again, at some point, they need to address the transfer of that ownership to someone or some other entity.
Right, right. And they got to define what they want to do with the rest of their life.
Absolutely.
Yeah. Now, we want to get into some nuts and bolts, but I want to kind of go over some of this real quickly. But, you know, the first step is they got to figure out, you know, what the business is worth, right?
Well, and that's a terribly subjective question. I mean, it depends on what the business is being valued for, what the purpose is. Is it for a divorce proceeding? Is it for an estate? Is it
right.
for gifting purposes to the next generation? Is it for an ESOP? Then you get into some really technical things, which I hope maybe we'll cover later, such as minority ownership interest, gifting, lack of marketability. Those are some things that go into the gifting process that a business owner can take advantage of to really make a tax-efficient transfer to the next generation.
Yeah. When an owner is valuing their business, Mike, I think it's probably a natural, since, you know, you maybe brought this business into the world and you got a lot of sweat equity and love in it, and you think that they need to kind of, like, remind themselves that it may not be as worth as much as you really think it is.
That's a great question.
Yeah,
that's a great question. One of the things that I have found, not just in business valuations, but in asset transfers in general.
Yeah.
The whatever it is that's being transferred is almost always worth more to the seller than to the buyer.
Yep.
You know, and there's always going to be some sort of negotiation that goes on, and that's why I initially said that putting a number on a company, unless it's publicly traded, because the market determines the value, unless it's publicly traded, it's a terribly subjective process, and there are a couple of credentials that people can get to help them value companies, and even they use multiple methods to put a number on a company.
Mm-hmm. Well, the most common method, though, is the earnings scenario, isn't it?
I'm sorry, say it again?
I said I don't know. This is what I've heard in interviewing folks for my writing, that earnings is probably the most commonly used way of getting the value of business.
Well, you on the short list, you could value it based on the net book value of the assets.
Yeah.
You could value it based on the discounted cash flows to the owner for a period of years. You can value it and take discounts for gifting purposes. So again, there are several ways to put a number on that company. Now, for instance, in my profession, an accounting firm, there's a rule of thumb that an accounting firm is going to sell from anywhere from 1x revenue to 1.2x revenue. It's a multiple of revenue. Now, in the financial services side of my business, practices can sell for anywhere from 5 to 12x revenue, just depends on what the makeup of your business is. So, again, there in some industries, there's a rule of thumb that may or may not be accurate, but it sometimes helps the buyer or the seller kind of hone in on a range that might be appropriate.
Yeah. Well, in many cases, like you said, it could be that the value of the property that it sits on is much more valuable than the profitability of the business itself, right?
Well, that's a good point. I mean, and generally, the real estate, if there's real estate involved, is owned by the business owner in a different entity, so it may be two different transactions. Real estate itself would probably be easier to put a number on than an operating business in many cases. Well, somewhat easier, maybe not foolproof, but maybe a little easier.
All right. Well, Mike, let's look at a couple of scenarios. I'm thinking about the people that I've spoken with since we announced that you were going to be the guest. And generally, what I see is people who own a growing business, and their thought is, you know, someday I'm going to want to sell this business. So, how far ahead of time, before we say we're going to go list it with a real estate broker, how far ahead of that date that the broker gets it, should the owner be taking care of details within the business? When I'm thinking of details, I'm expecting that prospective buyer is going to want to see your P&L for a certain number of years. And many retailers, may also service businesses, have a tendency to take certain personal expenses and find ways to claim them as a business expense, legitimately done?
They're liberal bookkeepers. that's a great question. I would say the business owner should start to clean up their books at least 3 years before they start talking to someone about potentially selling the business. They should start weaning themselves off of, really cutting themselves off altogether from running any questionable items through their P&L.
We're talking about the idea you're running your car through it and you're running your personal cell phone through it and you're putting your kids on the payroll.
Well, it could be something even more than that. It could be the owner's taking a salary that is higher or lower, for that matter, than what they would have to pay someone to fill that spot. Or they're paying their kid, who's a warehouse manager. Maybe they're paying them 2 or 3x the cost of someone to actually run that on their behalf. So it could be something like that as well. So those are the kinds of things that would need to be cleaned up. during the review or the analysis process, whoever's doing the analysis is going to kind of ferret those things out. They're going to look for opportunities to what they call it recasting the earnings or recasting the financial statements, and they're going to adjust the numbers that you give them based on industry averages, on finding things in the financial statements that are really owner expenses that they've somehow found a way to put through the P&L, and adjust for those and do that on every year that you give them. So they're going
to. So the idea is for 3 years you want a good clean one.
Absolutely, yeah. You want
okay for
3 years. At least 3 years, maybe further back than that, but 3 years would be, I would say, almost mandatory. If you were to, and that kind of goes back to a company that if you think about a company that is in the process of going public, they're going to offer shares of their company to the general public. They have to have 3 years of audited financial statements by a CPA. CPA has to sign off the financial statements. And that's kind of where that suggestion goes back to. It's 3 years of data, clean data.
Okay. But even for a small business, like, I mean, your background came out of the bicycle industry.
Yep.
So even for a person who's got a bicycle shop and they've got several employees, you know, not a big thing. They're doing, could be doing $700,000, $1 million, $2 million a year. You're suggesting that the 3 years prior to when they want to put it on the market, it's clean up the financials. As you use the word recast, make them look a little more legitimate.
Well, in other words, you need to bring off-book stuff on book, right?
Well, you need to stop running your personal expenses through the company.
Right, right.
Stop running. If your spouse doesn't work for the company should not buy their car, for example.
Right.
The family boat at the lake should not be on the company's books. Those are the kinds of things that a potential buyer is going to recast the financial statements for. And you should really do that ahead of time because, to the extent that something can be a business expense, I agree you should run it through the books. But if it's personal, you get into an audit exposure issue that becomes hard to defend if it were to come up. So those are kinds of things you should be doing anyway. It's not doing something you shouldn't be doing. It's something you should be doing, and because you're thinking of selling, you absolutely need to do it.
Right.
Okay. So now let's look at the idea of I want to value the business. The question surely is going to come up, so how much can I get for this? And I know from our conversations, there are multiple ways that you can come up with the number that you're going to tell the real estate person, here's what I want to sell. And I'm looking at it solely from the business side, not from the building, just solely from
just the
business.
Right, the operations, yeah.
So,
well, like I said, there are several ways. I mean, you can use the book the net book value of the assets. You can use the fair market value of the assets. You can have an appraiser come in and determine what that is. You can use a thumbnail number, 1x revenue, 5x net.
Okay, now wait. We're getting into CPA terms. Let's back those up.
Okay. Well, 1x revenue would be your gross sales times one, so you're saying you're selling if your revenue for last year was $3 million, and the thumbnail is 1x revenue, the sales price would be $3 million.
Okay. Now, are you saying $3 million, and that includes all the assets?
Yeah. Well, it depends on that way the deal is structured, because it could be depends on how the business is operating. A $3 million company is probably a corporation or being taxed as a corporation. So we're going to look at it from that aspect. So a company that's revenue generating $3 million could sell its assets for $3 million, and the corporation would still exist. Okay, that transaction is generally better for the buyer because the buyer is taking those assets and now he can depreciate them, okay, some of them. It's not so good for the seller in that situation because he's paying tax inside the corporation potentially. The transaction could also be structured as an equity sale. So you're selling your ownership interest in that entity, your shares or your membership interest to the buyer, and the entire business entity, LLC, corporation is all being transferred to the buyer. The seller gets the cash and no longer owns a corporation anymore. So
But now we have a situation, though. All right, we will have a situation that occurs at that point, that if I have my business in some form of a corporation, whichever the formats will be, then I sell the corporation. The problem that the buyer potentially has is that if somewhere down the line a lawsuit comes against the business for some service that they bought, then they just own the lawsuit. It doesn't stay with the person selling it.
I'm not an attorney, Tom, but you're correct, and that's why there are differences in the value. So the seller may say it's worth $3 million, but he wants it to be a stock sale. He's going to sell the corporation. To the buyer, well, I'm buying your corporation. I'm assuming the liabilities of that corporation. It's only worth 2.5 to me because I don't know what liabilities are out there. That's where the negotiation is going to come into play.
And the issue also comes up that if I buy your business, I buy your corporation, the assets, I cannot depreciate them because you've already done it. All right? I can continue what you've done, but I can't redo them. But if I buy the assets from you, whether I'm buying from you as a sole proprietor or as a corporation, if I buy the assets from you, then the price that I pay for them, I can now begin to depreciate them, irregardless of what you've depreciated.
That's right. Now, again, it goes back to what I said earlier about the value to the seller is almost always higher than to any buyer. Okay, how you structure the deal will have an impact on the ultimate selling price. The other issue that we didn't talk about is timing of payment. If it's an all cash deal for either the stock or the assets, the buyer is going to want some concession on the price, so it'll be lower. If the owner is financing a portion of it for a period of time, whether it's a year or 5 years, the price will be higher. Okay, so that's again another variable that will come into play in the negotiation process generally.
Okay, all right. So let's take our first station break, and then let's come back and hit that point one more time. Quick station break, and we'll come right back.
This is eRetailer Conversations on PBN, the Profitable Business Network.
So here we are for our last eRetailer Conversation of the year, December 10th, 2015. Our guest tonight is Mike McCormick. Mike is a certified tax coach and a certified public accountant. Mike is in Ohio. Specifically, he's in Blue Ash, Ohio, just outside of Cincinnati. And you can find Mike online at CincyTaxCoach.com, or his office phone number is 513-488-1121. So, Mike, what I want to go back with is this question. If a person comes up to you and is going to hand you all cash, the challenge that occurs for that point is that person's putting 100% cash in, and for the money that they could take out for themselves in the form of pay, dividends, if they could go someplace else and put 20% down and finance the business over a 10-year period, putting, say, $1 million down on a $1 million business, it's going to be a smaller one, but putting $1 million down on a $5 million business, logic would say, I'll be able to pull more money out of the $5 million business. Well, so I'd rather roll my money and let it work for me.
Well, that's a good point. Now, again, it's going to come down to what businesses are out there that you're interested in that you could buy and create some sort of leverage to buy that $5 million business. Is it a business that you're interested in? Is it just some people buy businesses just to own the business. They're not going to work in it. They're not going to pull a salary from it. They just want to grow it and sell it to the next guy. So it comes back to what are the goals of the owner or the purchaser of that asset.
Okay. But now the next concern I would have and having gone through this multiple times in our family, if I'm selling to you the business and you pay $1 million down and you're going to pay me $4 million over a period of time, I absolutely do not want the business as being the collateral for the loan.
Yeah, that's as an advisor to people who sell their businesses, I would agree. But the reality is that sometimes in order to get the deal done, the seller is willing to carry some of the paper, as we would say, and
right.
is willing to carry some portion. I have a client who's in the middle of selling a business right now. The initial value we put on it was about $1.1 million. They've negotiated it down to about $875, I think, and the buyers are bringing, I don't remember the numbers off the top of my head, say $300,000, and they have a bank loan for another $500,000. The bank wanted to put a lien on the two buyers' homes, and the buyers balked at that, so they wanted to go back to the seller and have him carry more of the purchase price, and he's just not willing to do that. He's not in a position where he absolutely needs to sell this business. You know, if he were another 20 years older or hurting for cash, he might be willing to do that. But it's a negotiating point for the ultimate selling price. Now, if the owner carries some of the loan, then normally that the ultimate amount that the seller would receive is going to be higher. You know, if the thumbnail is 1x revenue, but
right.
the seller is going to carry 20% of the sales price for 5 years, he should ultimately receive, say, 1.1 or 1.2 times revenue, okay, over
right.
the course of that payout, because he's taking risk. He should be compensated for that risk.
And
so
the risk is that they sell it. Their challenge is, if I sell you the business and you screw up or bad things happen to you, and the time that I can legally come after you to take repossession of my business, it could be all over. It could be the business is dead, you've sold the inventory, there's nothing there to reclaim.
Yeah. Right. Oh, yeah. That's exactly right. I mean, my client, part of the contract is that he continued to work in the business for at least 2 years as an employee. And he's fine with that. He doesn't have anything better to do other than work anyway. But if they start running into the ground after year three, you know, his only recourse is to take the business back and hopefully kickstart it and start bringing revenue and net income again. But it is a risk. That's definitely a risk, and that's why I'm saying the seller has to be compensated for that with increased sales price in some manner.
Yeah, I have seen that. I know of a business owner who was very talented in selling his business, taking repossession, and selling it, and did it 5 times.
Sure.
So in essence, every time he sold it, it was like a paid vacation that lasted
for six months,
and then he took it back.
Oh, wow, yeah.
He just became good at it by accident.
He became good at it by accident, and it's terribly expensive also, because you've got to get attorneys involved to formally do that.
Okay. All right, well, we're at the bottom of the hour. Our guest tonight is our Mike McCormick. Mike is a former small business owner. Currently, he is a certified public accountant and a certified tax coach. Mike's office is in Blue Ash, Ohio, located just outside Cincinnati. His phone is 513-488-1121, and his website is Cincy Tax Coach, C-I-N-C-Y, taxcoach.com. And one of the things I do want to mention is we have thrown around the names about legal entities and how you can own a business. I will put a plug in for Mike and tell you that he has a really good book on what are, in the United States, the choices you have for ownership. Things like sole proprietorship, partnership, LLC, sub-S, C-Corp, I know there's another one I'm forgetting off the top of my head, but in his book, it's partnerships. Okay, thanks, sir. And in his book, as you read it, it says, here's what qualifies to be in each one of them. Here's your pluses. Here's your minuses. Here's the tax consequences and things, how they happen. Am I correct remembering it's $25, Mike?
I think that's right. It's on Amazon. It's actually on Kindle now. We have books back in stock, and I'm going to send Tom a stack of them in the next couple of days as well.
It's good reading. I remember when I got my copy, read it cover to cover, easily understood, and I would say to anyone in business, even if you've been at whatever your legal format is for a number of years, it's a good book to go through and look at, because you can then sit down with your accountant and your attorney and say, let's rehash, rediscuss what type of legal entity my business is, because there is a potential that you would have a need to change. There's a potential you've outgrown your original format. So with that being said, we're going to take the bottom of the hour break. The song that we picked tonight is appropriate for those people who are thinking that they're going to sell their business, transfer it to someone else, and move on to something else in their life. And well, this will definitely age a few people like Bill Kendi and I, but the words are appropriate.
Happy trails to you until we meet again. Happy trails to you. Keep smiling until then. Who cares about the clouds if we're together? Just sing a song and bring the sunny weather.
Hi, how about that? Is that not what we're looking to have happen here?
Very nice.
Someone goes off in the sunset, and a good deal is when both people are happy. Glad you sold it, and glad the friend bought it. Mike, let's go back to this valuation. You gave an example and said that we might take a business and sell off the business at book value, which is book value meaning what the assets are listed for on your financial statement, or fair market, a negotiable point. Then that would include the inventory. And then we would get a number, I think I heard you correctly, a number on top of that of perhaps one times the gross sales.
Well, it's going to depend on how the deal is structured, Tom. The one times revenue, that would be the acquisition price of either the stock or the assets, okay, which would include the inventory and the equipment and everything else.
Okay, so I don't get both.
So you don't, yeah. If you negotiate the right deal, you might.
Okay.
it's the business being sold, and the buyer and the seller are going to have a significant impact on how that deal is structured and what it is you're getting for what dollars.
Okay. And our audience tonight is probably a heavy group of retailers. So that being the case, you were looking at your last 1 year or perhaps average of your last 3 years of what your revenue is?
Well, as the baseline, you would look at the most recent year because that's going to be the more likely predictor of what's going to happen in the future. But taking an average might be more close to the ultimate number that you arrive at.
Okay, so now, also, is this one point? Is this including that proverbial goodwill, blue sky type of thing?
Yeah, when you buy a company, if it's a stock sale, you're getting the whole company's kit and caboodle, and you just pick up and run it or absorb it into you, maybe your existing company. If you're buying the assets, some of the purchase price is going to be allocated to inventory, subject to a physical count at the date of the closing. Some of the purchase price is going, or sales price is going to be allocated to equipment and furniture and fixtures and all those sorts of things that are in the business. And the buyer is going to be able to start depreciating those over again. The difference between the sales price and the total of those two, equipment and inventory, is going to be goodwill. It's okay. It's to the buyer's advantage to keep that goodwill number as small as possible, but depending on the deal, it's going to be almost impossible to have it come out to zero. And the buyer,
so what we have
seller,
is the seller.
If I'm the seller
of the business, I got a couple of problems. My first one is that if I have on the books my fixtures equipment at $50,000, and I sell them for $100,000, saying that's the fair market value, but the book value is $50,000, then that $50,000 above the book value is completely taxable because I've made a profit on it. Is that correct?
That's correct. Yeah, you'll have okay. a gain on the sale of those assets. Some of it will be, depending on the original purchase price, some of it may be at recapture rates. I know it's kind of technical, but because you were able to write them off against ordinary income, you're going to pay 25% tax to the extent you depreciated them. Anything over and above that will be at 15%. Depending on the type of entity. If it's a corporation, it's just ordinary income tax. But if you're selling it from a sole proprietor or an LLC, there might be some tax differences there.
So when I am evaluating the business, if I sell inventory at what I have it on the books for, there's no tax consequence there. It's a straight flush. And that's making the assumption that the inventory that's on the books is really what the inventory is that's there.
Yes and no. I mean, if you sell it for your acquisition price, then it would be a wash. There would be no gain or loss.
Okay. And then we come to the number that everybody seems to always be interested in, is that goodwill or blue sky. Can you give us some formulas for how that number is calculated?
Well, like I said, it's going to be the difference between the sales price and the amount of the sales price that's allocated to the other assets. It's kind of a, we would call it a plug number. So if you sell it for $1 million and you have, say, $700,000 in inventory and $150,000 in equipment, your goodwill will be the difference, which is $150,000. And that's going to be written off over 15 years.
Okay. So let me throw this one as a possibility for calculation. How about if in selling a business, if I calculate it as saying I want my inventory at what we call landed cost, which is the cost of the inventory plus the freight bill to get it in on my sales floor.
Yeah.
I want to value my equipment at a fair market value. Can I take and calculate the goodwill, the blue sky, as being a factor against net profit over these, you mentioned 3 years earlier. Can I come up with a formula and come up with that as being it?
No,
you're talking about gross revenue or net profit?
Can I calculate profit?
You would use that to help determine what the gross sales number was, but you wouldn't really use that to determine the goodwill. Or ultimately, in a roundabout sort of way, you would, because you're determining what your selling price is, but that's indirectly determining goodwill, because the formula for determining goodwill is sales price minus your hard assets. The difference is your goodwill.
Okay. But what I'm curious about, though, is if I'm valuing the business and I'm basing it upon gross sales as compared to looking at against my net profit, it doesn't seem like I, as the seller of the business, am going to get rewarded for being able to run a streamlined operation that is more profitable. Because after all, it's not how much you run through the front door, it's how much you manage to put in your pocket at the end.
Well, again, those factors are going to come into determining what the ultimate selling price is. If you have accounting firm A and accounting firm B, and accounting firm A and the thumbnail value is 1x revenue, but firm A is a 100% tax shop doing 1040s, and their net income is 50% of gross, or you have accounting firm B who is a mix of different product types, different service types, and have, say, 30% of their revenue coming in evenly every month rather than all in the first part of the year, accounting firm B may be worth more. Okay, so you're going to adjust your sales price based on the buyers and the seller, for that matter, comparison of their own business against a competitor or the market.
And then we've got another way of calculating it that we'll talk about after
our
next little piece we need to throw in, and that is that funky little acronym we need to explain, which is the EBITDA. Or is that how are we pronouncing it correct?
EBITDA?
EBITDA? Okay.
EBITDA.
All right. Well, at that point,
earnings before income tax, depreciation, amortization.
Yeah. Okay. Quick break here at the 43 after the hour. I'm sorry, and then we will come right back.
This is the Profitable Business Network,
and this is December 10th, 2015. Our guest tonight with Bill Kendi and I is Mike McCormick, who is a certified tax coach and a certified public accountant. And we're discussing ways of selling a business. We don't have our recording as we usually do because I wasn't able to get the right time slot to get to our guest. But our guest coming in for January is a gentleman by the name of Ben Muldrow. And Ben is a principal at a company called Arnett Muldrow. Arnett Muldrow, I met them in a working trip in New York in October, and they were working with a Main Street community. And what they were very talented at is helping how you brand a business, including things like how you pick your colors and how you do the lettering of your name and things. And I thought, you know, it's a very important item starting off the year that we will look at. So January is going to bring us Ben Muldrow, and February is going to bring us the guy who is the founder of Cause Marketing. And let's see, January's program right now is scheduled to be on the 14th, and February's right now is scheduled to be on the 11th. So we've got a packed year coming up for us. Going back to Mike here, so you've said there are multiple ways that we can calculate the value of a business to sell them, and one of them is this earnings before income tax, depreciation, and amortization.
I always thought it was interest, taxes, depreciation, and amortization. Not income taxes, interest. Isn't that
right? Earnings before interest, taxes, depreciation, amortization.
Okay.
Right.
EBITDA. Got it.
Right. Not
income tax. So can you give us an explanation to that in terminology that all of us are going to grasp it?
Sure. In real quick terms, if you take a P&L or an income statement and take the net income, you are essentially going to add back some of the expenses that were taken on by the company. You're going to add back the interest. You're going to add back income taxes. You're going to add back depreciation, and you're going to add back amortization. That adjusted number is EBITDA, earnings before interest, taxes, depreciation, amortization. The reason you would do that is to get it to I would say somewhat of a common size if you're comparing it to a similar company, because the taxes may be different. They may have a different mix of fixed assets, so the depreciation and amortization is going to be different. So if you can add those expenses back, you can compare that company to a similar company.
Right. Now, Mike, I have a big question on that. and I've always wondered about this. What is the real difference between, well, explain to me three things, depreciation, defined appreciation, and tell me how that is different than amortization.
Well, they're both cost recovery methods. If you if you buy some assets, you can write them all off in 1 year. If you buy other types of assets, you're going to, we would say, recover or depreciate your acquisition price over a number of years. So if you buy a piece of machine, we're taking out of the conversation things like Section 179 and bonus depreciation. If you buy a piece of equipment for manufacturing, you're generally going to write that off over 5 years because the IRS says that's an asset that, it, one, is going to last more than 12 months, and we want you to write it off against earnings during the period in which that piece of equipment is in operation. So we're saying 5 years. For accounting purposes, it might be 20 years, but for tax purposes, it's a five-year life. Amortization, as we were saying before, the goodwill that we bought is going to be written off over 15 years, and that's where the amortization comes from. They're both cost recovery methods. They just fall under different terminology in accounting and in the tax code. They both do the same thing.
Well, can amortization be used for Blue Sky? Amortization is basically for an intangible, like a patent.
Goodwill isn't intangible, and there are different types of intangibles. And if you're buying goodwill, then you can write it off over 15 years. If you're creating goodwill, if you're through the operation of your business, you are generating an intangible like your customer list. You cannot write that off.
So customer list, you would classify as an intangible?
Yes. It's you can't touch it or feel it or see it or smell it or any of that kind of stuff. It exists. There is a value to it, but you can't. It's really tough to have somebody compare it to somebody else's.
Okay.
But there is value in things like that. I mean, for example, if I were going to open up a grocery store from scratch, we don't know if it's going to work. We don't know what unknown expenses are going to be out there. But if a guy across the street from me has a grocery store, there's the building, and I've looked at years of his financial statements. I see what's going on in his business. I know what kind of profit he makes. I know how to boil down his numbers to get past the ones we talked about in the first half hour, the family hidden expenses in there. And the neat part is that when I buy his business, the day I buy it, it's starting to make money. If I decide to start a store across the street, as soon as I buy land, I've got expense, and it may take me a year to get the thing up out of the ground.
Well, that's just it. If you're starting from scratch, you are building goodwill. You're creating goodwill. If you buy his company or buy his assets, you're buying his goodwill. Okay, you're buying that nebulous thing from him. And it has value. It certainly has value.
Well, absolutely. I know in our family, my father, and let's see, my father bought 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6 stores, and every time it was buy an existing store, it was never start one up. And I remember asking why, and he said, because I can always look at someone's business and tell you what I can do to change it and figure out if I can make more money. But to start from absolutely nothing, he says, you're starting with a premise.
Right. Your marketing costs are higher. Everything is more expensive. If you have a proven concept, let's talk about hardware stores or bicycle shops. If you have a bicycle shop that's doing well, you have a formula that works. It's going to be cheaper for you to go to another neighborhood and find a mediocre bike shop, buy them out, transform their location into something like you're already using, and come out ahead rather than going into a new neighborhood without any bike shop and starting from scratch.
Well, Mike, aren't you in effect, though, like Tom just said? You know, Tom, I know your dad bought 5 or 6 or grandfather or whatever, but the point is when you buy an existing business, you're buying an income for yourself.
Well, hopefully.
Well,
that's just it. Hopefully you're buying something that is going to not only provide an income for you, because otherwise you're just buying a job, but hopefully you're buying an asset that's going to appreciate. I mean, otherwise it wouldn't make sense to buy it. If you're just buying it to have a job for yourself, there are a lot less expensive ways and a lot less risky ways potentially to get a job.
Mm-hmm. Well, that kind of does. Go ahead, Tom.
And that's exactly it. And we know from all of us, from the trade shows that we've been at, there's a lot of people out there who fall in love with what the products and services they offer and do, in effect, buy themselves a job. And unfortunately, many of them say, well, I don't make what I could make salary-wise if I were out working someplace else, but I get to do what I enjoy. And my comment has always been, who told you that rule? Who said enjoying what you do should be taking the place of pay? Why can't you enjoy doing what you're doing and then make a crap load of money?
Right, make a living. Make more than a living at it.
You know, it really becomes rather complicated in a way if an owner doesn't kind of start at the very beginning and ask themselves, what do I want out of this? For example, I used to be in the newspaper business. I know a number of people that held a portion of having somebody take over their newspaper, and it went away. And, that's why it's kind of interesting that you, Mike, you talked about Blue Sky. Well, the only thing a magazine or a newspaper has is its name. It doesn't matter where it's printed. It doesn't matter. And, their subscriber list is a huge asset. But every industry is different, and it really kind of depends on, I would think, what the owner wants to get out of it, right?
Well, that's back to our original premise. Everything is going to depend on what the goals of the parties are. The buyer has their own agenda. The seller has theirs. And both of those, they'll have to come to some sort of agreement in the middle that works for both of them. Otherwise, the deal's not going to go through. Because most of the time, in the sale of a business, if it's not a distressed situation, both parties have to be satisfied. It's in my experience, it's difficult to have a buyer or a seller in this kind of transaction that's disgruntled, unless there's fraud involved, somebody lied. Otherwise, then why would the buyer buy and why would the seller sell?
Yeah, no, Mike. What happens when you have a long established, like Tom? I don't know what the name of your retail stores were, but
they're real original Shays.
Okay, so somebody buys Shays. Somebody buys Shays, and a Shay doesn't want to be there anymore. How does a Shay help a Kendi build Shays if Kendi who bought the store wants to change it to Kendi's?
Well, that happens all the time. My great uncle started a company here in Cincinnati called McCormick Equipment Company.
Yeah.
And over the years, the ownership has changed. There may still be some of his kids involved with it. I know they're still there. I'm not sure who are the shareholders in it anymore. But the primary shareholder, the majority shareholder, has not been a McCormick for probably 20 years, but the name is still McCormick Equipment. So it depends on how much brand awareness that name has in the market. If McCormick Equipment wasn't a valuable name, he would have changed it to, Z-Best Equipment or something. Who knows?
Right, but that's all part of Blue Sky, right?
Well, it's part of Goodwill. It's part of the Goodwill. In his transaction, it probably wasn't any Goodwill because I'm pretty sure that was a stock transaction. My uncle sold him shares in the company. Because probably a minority interest at the beginning, and then he gradually became the majority owner over a period of years. So it was a stock transaction, not an asset transaction.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. And sometimes for personal reasons, the last business that our family bought, they had their name on the building, and it's a very hard and fast condition of the sale. I mean, there was like no negotiating. It was, you have 180 days to get our name off everything.
Yeah.
Not just off the building, off the glass, and and every piece of paper that has our name on it, every form, internal and external, you better get them used in 6 months or get them in the trash can. but we want yep. everything that's got our name on it. And yet years and years continued on when people would still remember the business. I can see folks today and I'll mention the family name. Oh, well, they owned that business. I go, yeah, they owned it before us.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Well, just a personal choice. They want it out.
That's sometimes right. there, that can be a hurdle to selling and buying and success.
So it takes a little bit of everything there to, you know, for it. And again, that becomes a negotiation because we could have come back and said, wow, that's going to cost us a lot of money if we can't
that's
keep
right.
the name. I'm going to give you some less because now I've got to go rip out all the signage off all the building, all the sides,
right.
and if I've got
right.
delivery vehicles, I got to have those repainted. And
it all comes down to negotiation. You know, both parties are going to have to come to an agreement that works for both of them on payment terms, on names, on the seller being an employee for a number of years, possibly, or maybe their son works in the business and they don't think he can get a job somewhere else. So you're gonna hire Johnny and he's gonna work for you for at least 4 years. I've seen it. You know, it's all part of the negotiation process.
So that can be a challenge there that, you know, maybe I don't want. I can tell you in our family experience, every time that we bought a business and said, oh, it's so important to keep old employees,
yeah,
it wasn't that many months down the line that we looked at it and said, you know, we were mistaken.
Yeah.
When you have someone new own a business, there are changes that come, and old employees don't often like new changes.
Sometimes it's better to groom.
So anyway, well, that's it for tonight, folks. We have to let Mr. Mike get back to what he's doing. Our guest tonight has been Mike McCormick. Mike is the Cincy Tax Coach. You can find Mike online, Cincy, C-I-N-C-Y, taxcoach.com. You write Mike, let's see, Mike at CincyTaxCoach.com, right, Mike?
Yes, sir. Yep, that's it.
Okay. It's on autopilot in mine. I never remember what I'm writing. It's Mike at Cincy Tax Coach. Phone number in Cincinnati is 513-488-1121. And as we spoke very briefly, Mike's book, Mike has two books out there. I've read both of them, good books. Favorite of mine is the initial one, and I think it's great reading. It's I say this one, the price of the book is a whole lot less than the amount of time that you're going to spend sitting with an attorney or with a CPA and having them try to explain to you what they see of the six different business entities. I think it makes sense to read the book, understand what the six are, so that you can have an intelligent conversation with them and you can participate. I just think it's better that when an owner of a business participates in the conversation, instead of someone just telling them this is how you do it, sure makes a whole lot more sense. At least it does to me. That being said, Mike, thank you for tonight. Thanks for joining us. Appreciate you giving us some time and giving us some thoughts on this one, because we know we had a lot of people asking about this very topic tonight, about how do I value it. And one of the key factors Mike said tonight is 3 years. Look out 3 years ahead of time. Don't wake up tomorrow and say, now I'm ready to sell it. And Bill Kindy, let's see, we've been together another year here. Thank you, sir. I appreciate that you take the time to come and join me.
Well, I figured that you and I are both getting younger. And if we're not getting younger, maybe we enjoy the sound of the next sound that our listeners will hear, right?
That is it. And it's our closing sound for the closing year. So best to everybody. Thanks for being with us, and we'll see you in January.
It's been our pleasure to share fresh ideas and trends from premier small business owners, coaches, and resources. Join Tom Shea and guests again next month for e-retailer conversations right here on PBN, the Profitable Business Network.